This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is the recording of the Wall Street Journal for Monday, April 29th, 2024. I'm Kim Sheridan. Articles read today are primarily from the front page, with additional articles coming from the U.S. News section of the newspaper. Market values from last week are as follows. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 38,239.66, up 253.26, or 0.67%. NASDAQ closed at 15,927.90, up 4.2%. Stocks 600 closed at 507.98, up 1.7%. The 10-year Treasury was down 13 thirty-seconds, with a yield of 4.668%. The price of oil was $83.85 a barrel, up $1.63. The value of the euro, $1.0693, and the yen, 158.34. We begin today's reading with a front-page article entitled Germany's Nazi Past Haunts Push to Seize Russian Assets by Bojan Pansevsky and Lawrence Norman from Berlin. The specter of World War II hangs over Western attempts to funnel Russian assets to Ukraine's defense against Moscow. Berlin has emerged as a fierce opponent of the U.S.-led push to commandeer some of the nearly $300 billion of Russian central bank assets frozen at the start of Russia's war on Ukraine. Germany fears it could create a precedent and inspire new claims over World War II-era crimes. The U.S. and U.K. have said the initiative is crucial for a Ukrainian victory, but there is little chance of progress without wider European support. The funds, several times the size of the recently approved $61 billion U.S. aid package for Ukraine, would bolster Ukraine's ailing armed forces and help rebuild the country. Two-thirds of the Russian money at play sits in Europe's clearinghouses, and 2 years into the war, Germany has only just backed using the windfall profits to fund Ukrainian arms. Paris, Rome, and the European Central Bank also are hesitant in case taking hold of the reserves hits international confidence in the euro and single currency assets. The Group of Seven is divided, with Japan, which faces reparation claims of its own from South Korea and other neighbors, in opposition. The Japanese Foreign Ministry said it would continue to discuss the issue with G7 partners. Demands for further World War II reparations have dogged Germany for decades, at times souring relations with its neighbors. After the war, Berlin paid the Allied powers and the then Soviet Union compensation for Germany's war of aggression. Since 1952, Germany has also given more than $90 billion to Holocaust survivors and their families, according to Jewish organizations. But recently, calls for further reparations have reemerged. Poland has sought $1.3 trillion in compensation from Berlin since 2022, while Greece since 2019 has asked for more than $300 billion. Germany has said its post-war payments and a 1990 treaty that anchored the country's borders following its reunification settled the issue. The then Soviet Union and the U.S. were signatories to the treaty. Poland, Greece, and Italy weren't involved. In 2004, when Poland joined the European Union, Berlin agreed not to support claims against Warsaw from millions of Germans expelled and expropriated. Poland, in turn, dropped its compensation claims, but the issue has remained an irritant. When we talk about executioners, victims, punishment, suffering, we demand not only memory, not only the truth. We demand compensation. then Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki of Poland said in September. Courts in Italy, which the Nazis invaded after Benito Mussolini's regime collapsed in 1943, have in recent years awarded restitution to families of victims of the occupation. Some courts then attempted to seize German state assets. Germany took Italy to the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, where a ruling is pending. Berlin argues international law prohibits individuals from making claims against states in foreign courts and that state assets are immune from seizure. Violating this principle in Russia's case would undermine Germany's long-standing legal position, Berlin officials said. Russia's foreign ministry has said that confiscating Russian assets would be 21st century piracy. Some Russian officials have warned they would retaliate. The Polish state received little compensation after World War II. During the Cold War, its then Soviet rulers transferred looted German machinery and ships in lieu of compensation. Germany later paid $270 million to individual claimants in Poland, where it caused widespread destruction and left between 5 million and 6 million people dead. The communist Polish government dropped its compensation claims against its East German Warsaw Pact ally in 1953. But the issue returned to prominence after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. Andreas Ruder, professor of contemporary history at the Johannes Gutenberg University Mainz in Germany, said the Italian and Polish claims against Germany are valid, as is Berlin's refusal to honor them in full. Yet successive German governments made a mistake by taking a legalistic approach, he said. Germany was comfortable in its erroneous assumption that the problem had been resolved and deliberately avoided the issue for decades, so it shouldn't be surprised that Poland and Greece now say they have unfinished business, Ruder said. Germany also argues that Russian assets should be left intact to use as leverage in any talks to end the war and induce Russia to cede some Ukrainian territory it occupies. Slawomir Debski, head of PISM, a think tank, said another motivation for Berlin could be shielding German companies still operating in Russia from retaliation. Within the G7, a complicated compromise might be starting to emerge. The U.S. has proposed that the group front-load 10 years of profits, essentially interest payments on matured assets, from the frozen funds. That money would act as collateral for a bond issued by a special-purpose vehicle set up by the G7 to raise money for Ukraine. G7 countries would guarantee the debt. Europeans have their own plan to use interest generated by frozen Russian assets to pay for weapons and reconstruction for Ukraine. That is likely to go ahead soon, although EU officials said Europe could join the U.S. plan in 2025. Talks are at an early stage. President Biden signed a law this month authorizing seizure of Russian sovereign assets under U.S. jurisdiction, $5 billion to $6 billion, congressional officials said. We're looking at a series of possibilities ranging from actually seizing the assets to using them as collateral, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said this month. The U.S. argues that under international law, countries can take otherwise unlawful countermeasures against a country violating its international obligations. But there are disagreements over whether any country other than Ukraine is entitled to apply countermeasures. Initially, U.S. officials also worried that confiscating Russian assets could backfire against Washington and allies such as Israel. The U.S. has since argued that only directly affected countries, such as Ukraine's main backers, whose security is threatened and who are paying for some of Kyiv's defense, would be entitled to confiscate assets. Bart Sedgwick, who previously advised the European Commission and worked at the ICJ, said that Berlin's concerns are unwarranted. The logic behind countermeasures clearly applies only to current and ongoing violations of international law, rather than those that occurred 80 years ago, he said. Our next front page article is entitled, Musk Seeks Key Approval for Tesla in China, by Rafaela Huang and Selena Cheng. Elon Musk met with senior Chinese officials in Beijing on Sunday as he pushes for approval to introduce Tesla's advanced driver assistance technology in its biggest overseas market, where it has been losing ground to homegrown electric vehicle makers. Musk is stepping up efforts globally for wider adoption of Tesla's full self-driving, or FSD, software feature after a dismal start to the year for the world's most valuable automaker, which saw its first quarter profit drop to its lowest level since 2021. Tesla's chief executive is seeking to persuade Chinese regulators to greenlight the introduction of its FSD feature to Chinese drivers, according to people familiar with the discussions. Among those he met with was Chinese Premier Li Qiang. Tesla has opened FSD for subscription in China, but it only provides lower-level autonomous features for use, leaving it lagging behind EVs made by some Chinese brands that can drive near automatically in most scenarios. In China, Tesla faces government restrictions over the data its cars can collect near sensitive sites, and it isn't allowed to transfer its Chinese data out of the country. Musk would like to transfer data to the U.S. to create a bigger pool that could better train the driver assistance feature, the people said. That is a potentially thorny issue, given Beijing regards protecting such data as a matter of national security. Failure to win approval for FSD could erode the attractiveness of Tesla cars in the world's most crowded EV market. Tesla last week halved the subscription price of FSD in the U.S. to entice adoption. On Friday, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration opened an investigation into Tesla's more basic driver assistance system, which the authority said is tied to avoidable crashes and fatalities. Tesla didn't respond to a request for comment on the probe. Tesla faces mounting challenges amid a cooling in consumer demand for EVs. It is cutting more than 10% of the global workforce after it reported falling revenue in the first quarter of the year and a sharp drop in profit. Tesla's sales in China of its vehicles made in the country slid last quarter by almost 4% from a year ago, while the rest of the EV market recorded 15% growth over the same period. Workers at Tesla's Shanghai factory said Sunday that they were asked to work on the weekend in anticipation of Musk's visit to the country. The plant is usually shut on weekends after the company dialed back work shifts in March amid weakening demand. Last week, Musk postponed a trip to India, where he was expected to meet with Prime Minister Narendra Modi and unveil plans for Tesla's entry into the country. Tesla's development in China is a successful example of economic and trade cooperation between China and the U.S., the Chinese premier told Musk during their meeting Sunday, according to state broadcaster China Central Television. Tesla is willing to further deepen the cooperation with China, Musk told Li, according to CCTV. Reuters earlier reported the visit. Tom Zhu, a senior executive considered key to Tesla's growth in China, and Grace Tao, who oversees Tesla's external relations in the country, joined Musk's meeting with officials, who included China's top economic planner and commerce minister. Tesla's lofty market valuation rests in part on the promise of its driving technology. The FSD system is an advanced version of the company's autopilot technology and is designed to help with driving tasks such as steering and lane changes. We plan on, with the approval of the regulators, releasing it as a supervised autonomy system in any market that where we can get regulatory approval for that, which we think includes China, Musk said during Tesla's earnings call last week. The latest version of Tesla's self-driving capability is based only on artificial intelligence, and the company is working on expanding its core AI infrastructure and training capacity. Musk said during the call, Chief Financial Officer Vaibhav Taneja urged investors to regard Tesla as more than a car company. Tesla has emphasized in users' manuals that the software doesn't allow for fully autonomous driving and requires active driver supervision. Tesla mainly relies on real-time visual data its car cameras collect to power its driving assistance features, instead of using optical radar signals to identify traffic, a technology route that most Chinese car makers have applied. Earlier this month, Huawei Technologies launched its camera-based autopilot technology, which the Chinese company said was more powerful than Tesla's most advanced autopilot feature currently available in China. China has banned Tesla's cars from entering military sites and venues of government agencies and state-owned companies over concerns that data collected by the vehicles could pose national security risks. The ban has been enforced more strictly in some cases, covering places including airports, train stations, and public parking lots at police stations. In recent years, concern over cybersecurity risks posed by data amassed by vehicles has prompted Beijing to require such data to be stored in China. Tesla has said that all data generated by its cars sold in China would be stored locally in a data center it built in 2021. To improve its FSD capabilities and have the technology better work in Chinese traffic, Tesla will need data collected from China to help train the technology. Tesla's Tao said autonomous driving technology is a key growth engine of the EV industry, according to a commentary published by People's Daily, the Communist Party's flagship newspaper, on Friday. Tesla has led the industry in autopilot technology from computing power, fleet size, and data to models, she wrote in the article. She also highlighted that Musk has said he is willing to license Tesla's driving assistance capabilities to other car companies. Next on the front page is an article entitled High Rates Appear on Track to Persist Long Term by Nick Timireos. Amid the debate over whether and when the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates, another important argument is unfolding. Where do rates settle in the long run? At issue is the neutral rate of interest, the rate that keeps the demand and supply of savings in equilibrium, leading to stable economic growth and inflation. For the past 40 years, and especially following the 2008 financial crisis, economists and Fed policymakers steadily revised down their estimates of neutral. This view became embedded in bond yields, mortgage rates, equity prices, and countless other assets. But now, some see reasons for neutral rising, with the potential to change a wide range of asset prices. The neutral rate, sometimes called R asterisk or R star, can't be directly observed, only inferred. 5 years ago, after the Fed raised its benchmark federal funds rate to 2.4%, officials saw signs of feeble growth and inflation and began lowering rates, implying neutral must have been around that level or lower. But when the Fed raised the Fed funds rates to 5.3% last year, the highest since 2001, the economy appeared to shrug it off, giving reason to think neutral might be higher. The economy has weathered this exceptionally well. No one could have told me 10 years ago we would have raised rates to this level with this outcome, said Joe Davis, chief global economist at Vanguard. Our conviction in a higher neutral rate is going up as Every quarter of data comes in. The persistence of strong demand doesn't necessarily mean neutral has risen. It might simply mean higher rates have yet to work their way through the financial system. Households and businesses have locked in their borrowing at low rates, might be relatively insulated from the recent rise in rates. Based on the resilience of economic activity to higher interest rates, one conclusion you could draw is that R star must be higher. Another conclusion you could draw, which I think is totally valid based on seeing the same set of information, is that the economy is just not that sensitive to interest rates, said Chris Dawsey, head of economic research at hedge fund manager D.E. Shaw. Modeling the effects of interest rates therefore requires not only an estimate of neutral, but also of how sensitive spending is to rate changes and the lag between spending and prices. That's a lot to get right, especially when errors in one area can easily be mistaken for misestimates elsewhere, said Jason Thomas, chief economist at private equity manager Carlyle Group. Every quarter, federal officials project the longer-run interest rate, which is, in effect, their estimate of neutral. Their median estimate declined from 4.25% in 2012 to 2.5% in 2019. After subtracting inflation of 2%, that yielded a real neutral rate of 0.5%. The median then crept up to 0.6% in March, though that understates the amount of movement in those estimates. In March, 9 of 18 officials put neutral above 0.5%. 2 years earlier, just two did. Cleveland Fed President Loretta Mester said after years of penciling in a long-run rate estimate of 2.5%, she revised her projection last month to 3%. The debate over R-star might have little near-term effect on the Fed because current interest rates are above virtually all estimates of neutral. That means they are restraining growth and prices and more likely to fall than rise. If growth remains solid and inflation stubborn, it might lead to speculation neutral has risen, and thus current interest rates aren't that tight, and thus the Fed has less reason to cut rates. Alternatively, if inflation resumes its decline, questions about neutral would drive how much the Fed ultimately cuts rates. The Fed wants to normalize policy, but normalize to where? Said David Merrickle, chief U.S. economist at Goldman Sachs. They are not going to stay in the fives, but normalization is not going to take them all the way to 2.5%, where in the threes or fours they feel comfortable stopping is still up in the air. There are several factors cited for why neutral might be rising: soaring government deficits and strong investment driven by the green energy transition and an artificial intelligence-fueled frenzy for electricity-intensive data centers. Higher productivity from AI could also lift long-run growth and the neutral rate. Dallas Fed President Lori Logan warned in a recent speech that interest rates might not be as restrictive as believed because of a higher neutral rate. Failing to recognize a sustained move up in the neutral rate could lead to over-accommodative monetary policy, she said. Investors have already concluded interest rates aren't likely to return to the low levels that prevailed before the pandemic. Interest rate futures suggest the Fed funds rate will stabilize around 4% in coming years. Others are skeptical that neutral is rising. New York Fed President John Williams, who co-wrote a widely followed model of R-star, has said he expects an aging global workforce that boosts savings to keep neutral low. Fed Chair Jerome Powell and some colleagues have suggested that economic strength could as easily be explained by idiosyncrasies of the pandemic, such as a boost in the supply of workers last year from immigration. It's not that the policy isn't restrictive and it's not responsive to rates. It's that we've had this outside force that is temporarily affecting that, Powell said at a talk this month. Fed Governor Christopher Waller has said he thinks R-star is around 0.5%. You have to explain to me why real rates on safe, liquid government debt fell for 40 years and why suddenly it turned around, he said last month. No one has really given very good answers to that. Several economic models attempt to estimate neutral, but they have wide error bands and are prone to revision. Given the imprecision, Powell has implied the Fed must act on the assumption it doesn't really know where R-star sits. We only know it by its works, he said last year. Also found on the front page is this article entitled Longevity Scientist Draws Ire of Peers by Alex Janine, Dominique Mossbergen, and Amy Doxter Marcus. Harvard geneticist David Sinclair, who has said his biological age is roughly a decade younger than his actual one, has put forward his largely unlined face as a spokesman for the longevity movement. The 54-year-old has built his brand on the idea that aging is a treatable disease. The notion has proven so seductive that legions of acolytes follow his online postings about his research and the cocktails of supplements he consumes to stave off the inevitable. His social media accounts are a platform for assertions that his work is pushing nearer to a fountain of youth. He claims last year that a gene therapy invented in his Harvard lab and being developed by a company he co-founded, Life Biosciences, had reversed aging and restored vision in monkeys. Next up, age reversal in humans, he wrote on X and Instagram. On February 29th, in the eyes of many other scientists working to unlock the mysteries of aging, he went too far. Another company he co-founded, Animal Biosciences, quoted him in a press release saying that a supplement it had developed had reversed aging in dogs. Scientists who study aging can't even agree on what it means to reverse aging, much less how to measure it. The response was swift and harsh. The Academy for Health and Lifespan Research, a group of about 60 scientists that Sinclair co-founded and led, was hit with a cascade of resignations by members outraged by his claims. One scientist who quit referred to Sinclair on X as a snake oil salesman. Days later, in a tense video meeting, the Academy's five other board members pressed Sinclair to resign as president. He contended that the press release contained an inaccurate quote, according to people who were in the meeting, but he later stepped down. Sinclair's work is published regularly in top-tier scientific journals and has brought attention to an emerging field vying for credibility and funding. He has parlayed his research into hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in various companies, more than 50 patents, and prominence as a longevity influencer. Along the way, his claims, especially in his social media posts, interviews, and his book, have drawn criticism from scientists who have accused him of hyping his research and extolling unproven products, including some from companies in which he had a financial interest. My lab's ideas and findings are typically ahead of the curve, which is why some peers might feel the research is overstated at the time, Sinclair said to the Wall Street Journal in an email. I stand behind my track record as a trusted scientist in one of the most competitive professions of all. He said he doesn't engage with social media critics, including those calling him a snake oil salesman, and that many such comments are nothing more than mischaracterizations. Dr. Nir Barzilay, the new president of the Academy for Health and Lifespan Research and the director of the Institute for Aging Research at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, said Sinclair's comment about the dog research and his commercial interest in animal biosciences crossed a line. The data is not good. You're calling it the wrong thing, and then you're selling it, he said. The selling is a step too far. Sinclair said he adheres to Harvard's conflict of interest policies. His dog supplement company, Animal Biosciences, issued a reworded press release backing away from the claim of reversing aging. Longevity industry. The search for eternal youth has fueled a longevity industry that attracted roughly $43 billion in global investment in the past decade, according to research and media company Longevity Technology. Companies are exploring techniques such as rejuvenating cells with an aim to reverse disease and restore cell functions that can diminish with age. The pushback against how Sinclair portrays his work reflects a conviction that a field once considered fringe is gaining legitimacy. Some longevity researchers caution that rejuvenating some cells isn't the same thing as reversing aging in people. Reversal of aging is a term I stay away from. The evidence in humans isn't there, said Dr. Bruce Yanker, a professor of genetics and neurology at Harvard and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for Biology of Aging Research. Sinclair and other scientists have studied whether substances, including resveratrol, a compound in red wine, and the diabetes drug metformin, could extend life. Researchers have also explored the potential of supplements, including fisetin, found in fruits and vegetables, to eliminate cells that are senescent or that have stopped dividing but don't die. Sinclair has touted all three compounds as part of his own regimen. Rafael DeCabo, a senior investigator and chief of the translational gerontology branch at the National Institute on Aging, co-wrote studies on resveratrol in mice with Sinclair. He said there isn't enough evidence to support humans taking the supplement. In the absence of some clinical trials with the clinical application, it's a gamble, he said. We do not know what the compound is going to do. Dr. Danielle Berlardo, a cardiologist in Los Angeles, said she gets requests for off-label metformin from patients who have read Sinclair's 2019 bestseller, Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To. She said she encourages patients to stop using supplements, including resveratrol, that Sinclair and other longevity influencers have said they take. At best, it's wasted money, she said. I am careful to say that what I do may not be the best thing for others, Sinclair said. He said evidence shows resveratrol has health benefits in animals and people. Sinclair was born in Sydney, Australia, and earned a PhD in molecular genetics at the University of New South Wales. At 26, he joined the lab of Massachusetts Institute of Technology Professor Leonard Garante, who was trying to understand the biological causes of aging. He has done a lot of good work over the years, said Garante, who describes himself as a mentor and advisor. Sinclair's public statements, he said, are what often cause controversy. He cannot put a boundary on his enthusiasm, so it bubbles over and he says stuff, he said. I have talked with him many times about it, and he can't contain himself. Sinclair moved in 1999 to Harvard, where he became a tenured professor. His lab there found that resveratrol appeared to prolong the lifespan of mice. The National Institute on Aging's Interventions Testing Program reported in 2011 and 2013 that resveratrol didn't extend the lifespan of healthy mice. Resveratrol is still being studied in humans, and researchers have reported varying results. Sinclair started companies and built his public persona as a longevity influencer. His knack for synthesizing complicated research into bite-sized takeaways has attracted health enthusiasts to his appearance on Joe Rogan's and Peter Attia's podcasts and his TED Talks, including Can a Pill a Day Keep Aging Away? And A Cure for Aging. Tally Health, a company Sinclair co-founded, sells a test to measure biological age and longevity supplements, including one containing resveratrol. The company's chief executive officer, Melanie Goldie, acknowledged the controversy around resveratrol and told the journal in April that company scientists are independently evaluating its efficacy to determine whether the company still stands behind the compound. The company still sells the supplement that includes resveratrol and said it is always reviewing the efficacy of all its ingredients. Reverse aging. In February, Sinclair and his brother, Nick Sinclair, who is Animal Biosciences CEO, emailed the journal about research the company was planning to share about a dog supplement it had developed. Results from clinical trial in dogs to reverse aging, said the subject line of one email. The study, which was conducted by the North Carolina State College of Veterinary Medicine, enrolled 70 dogs. It concluded that even dogs that received a placebo showed cognitive improvement, but those that got a full dose of the supplement showed the largest improvement. The study is undergoing peer review and could change, said Brandon Belts, a spokesman for the school. The release that went out on February 29th quoted Sinclair praising his colleagues for having developed the first supplement proven to reverse aging in dogs. Matt Kaberline, a longevity researcher who co-directs a large study on aging in dogs, read the release and felt Sinclair's claims about the dog supplement went too far. Kaberline, who worked in the same MIT lab as Sinclair in the 1990s, emailed more than a dozen peers, including some members of the Academy for Health and Lifespan Research, on March 1st that he planned to resign. Conning people into believing that this stuff will reverse aging in their pets is disgusting behavior, he wrote in an email. 2 days later, Kaberline publicized his resignation on X, calling Sinclair a snake oil salesman. Sinclair said a public relations company inadvertently distributed an early version of the Animal Biosciences release. The actual quote that I had approved was proven to reverse the effects of aging in dogs, he said. I felt this was a reasonable statement. The agency, GCW, said it distributed a release the company provided. On March 5th, it reissued the release with an amended quote from Sinclair, who said the supplement was shown to reverse the effects of aging-related decline in dogs. On March 8th, Sinclair sent a text to the Academy's internal WhatsApp group apologizing for sharing his view of what constitutes age reversal in a way that brought negative attention to the group. The same day, the Academy's 6 board members, including Sinclair, sent an email to members attempting to quell the controversy. No single member speaks for the Academy, they wrote. They promised to expand the Academy's bylaws to outline language people should use in public statements about work in which they have a financial stake. 3 more Academy members submitted their resignations soon after. One said in his resignation letter that the response was inadequate from a group of widely published scientists who should know better. It slowly became the David Sinclair Show, said Andrew Dillon, a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley, who resigned. He's representing me through the Academy, and I don't want to be associated with that. Tony Weiss-Corre, a professor of neurology at Stanford University, who also resigned from the Academy, said it should form a committee to investigate conflicts of interest. The Academy should be an absolutely clean, scientifically driven guidepost for the public, he said. Barzilay, the new president, said he is forming such a committee. Arlen Richardson, an Academy member and biochemist at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center, read Sinclair's dog supplement study and thought about his Tibetan terrier, Zorro. Pet lovers would pay handsomely for dog chews they thought would extend an animal's life, he recalls thinking, and that Sinclair was preying on very vulnerable people. He submitted his resignation from the Academy. Barzilay and his fellow board members held a video call that weekend without Sinclair. They decided the Academy needed to move forward without Sinclair as its head. Soon after, they held a video meeting with Sinclair. The words in the original press release had been incorrect, he told them. One board member said it wasn't the only time Sinclair had claimed to have reversed aging. The conversation was tense. Sinclair agreed to step down as president. He's very hurt, Barzilay said later. Sinclair said to the journal that he regrets using language suggesting age reversal in dogs and pledged to be more accurate with my words in the future. He said he wasn't asked to step down as president. On March 13th, the Academy's five remaining board members sent an email announcing Sinclair had resigned as president. We hope we can move past these events. The Academy is about science and scientists. All else is secondary, they wrote. This front page article bears the title, Fast Food Prices Get Upsized in California, by Heather Haddon. Restaurants for months have said menu prices in California would rise as the state raised the minimum wage for fast food workers. Now they are following through. Consumers picking up burgers, burritos, and chicken sandwiches at chains in the Golden State are grappling with prices that for months have been rising at a faster clip than in other states, according to market research firm DataCentral. Since September, when California moved to require large fast food chains to bump up their minimum hourly pay to $20 in April, fast food and fast casual restaurants in California have increased prices by 10% overall, outpacing all other states, the firm found in an analysis of thousands of restaurants across 70 large chains. Prices at Chick-fil-A, Domino's, McDonald's, Burger King, Pizza Hut, Jack in the Box, and other fast food chains have increased since September, the firm found. Chipotle said in an investor call Wednesday that prices at its nearly 500 California restaurants climbed 6% to 7% during the first week of April, compared with last year, playing out across its menu. The state isn't making it easy, Chipotle chief executive Brian Nichol said in an interview. In Los Angeles, on a recent April afternoon, Seth Amitin, a 39-year-old therapist, said his usual $16 meal that he picks up weekly at the Chick-fil-A in Hollywood now costs $20. The price for a spicy chicken sandwich at that location had gone up to $7.09 from $6.29, or 13%, since mid-February, according to research by Gordon Haskett Research Advisors. Chick-fil-A's prices increased 10.6% on average in California during that time period, Gordon Haskett found. There's a really good taco spot just down the street. They kept their burrito prices at $10. I'm definitely eating there more often, Amitin said. California raised the minimum wage for fast food workers to $20 an hour in April, a 25% increase from the state's broader $16 minimum wage. Supporters, including California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, said the law would improve wages and working conditions for hundreds of thousands of fast food employees in the state. A spokesman for the governor said fast food companies can afford to give their workers a deserved bump in pay. These are wages that will go towards basic necessities like rent and groceries, he said. The restaurant industry spent millions of dollars fighting the wage law and was ready to mount a referendum campaign, but then negotiated a deal with backers last September. McDonald's, Jack in the Box, Shake Shack, and others said they would raise menu prices in California in response, with some McDonald's franchisees estimating hundreds of thousands of dollars per restaurant in added labor costs. California restaurants already had some of the highest fast food prices in the country, according to market research firm Revenue Management Solutions. Every month since October, California fast food and fast casual restaurants have raised prices across a greater percentage of their menus compared with restaurants in the rest of the country, DataCentral found. Greg LeVay, a 79-year-old retired entrepreneur from San Diego who worked in the retail office furniture business, said he noticed McDonald's hamburgers in his area creeping up to $2.50 each. A Big Mac now goes for $5.39, he said. He said he used to visit McDonald's a few times a month, but a few months ago started to limit his restaurant spending to sit-down restaurants for dinner. I feel ripped off a little, he said. Restaurant owners working for franchise chains such as McDonald's and Burger King set their own prices, while Chipotle and other companies that owned their domestic stores determined their menu costs. McDonald's said it is committed to providing good value for customers, and the company and its franchisees set up a team to aid its California business. McDonald's is competitive when it comes to affordability across the state, the company said. A Jack in the Box spokeswoman said the company has increased prices around 7% in its company-owned stores compared with last year. She said the company and its franchisees have sought to run stores more efficiently in response to the increased costs associated with the wage increases. Customers across the country are starting to pull back on restaurant visits after eateries pushed up their prices in response to inflation, industry data show. California consumers like Shandu Siram, a 50-year-old architect in Eastvale, said he previously didn't bat an eye at how much his family of four spent on fast food, but now has started to make fewer runs to Chipotle and Starbucks. He might go further. For now, we are keeping track of our spending at these places, and if our spending goes up, we'll look to cut back, Siram said. He is heading more often to Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen for deals at the chicken chain. A number of California consumers said they were shifting their restaurant spending to independent eateries, considering them a better value and experience than some chains. The California wage law doesn't apply to restaurants with fewer than 60 national locations. John Matthews, a 62-year-old project manager from Imperial Beach, California, said he believes the fast food wage law is a drag on the state economy, and he doesn't support it. He said he has shifted his roughly $600 in monthly restaurant spending to independent sit-down restaurants and away from McDonald's, Chipotle, and other chains. I'm still eating out, though much more selectively, Matthews said. Priced Out of the American Dream by Eric Wallerstein. Just married and with a newborn son, Anthony and Caitlin Fumo expected their well-paying jobs and chunk of savings to support a move closer to their parents in the suburbs of New Jersey. But leaving their 1,000-square-foot Philadelphia row home means borrowing with rates around 7%. To buy in a market where the typical home value has jumped 40% since the start of 2020. Their 3.85% mortgage costs $1,500 a month. They are looking at payments of around $4,000 if they move. Friends who scooped up their forever homes during the pandemic refinancing boom, meanwhile, are able to raise multiple children and support a long-term mortgage comfortably, said Anthony, a 31-year-old accounting consultant. A longtime rule of thumb in American homeownership, buy a starter home, then move up to a bigger place, doesn't feel like it works anymore. It feels like we make too much money to still feel like we're behind, Anthony said. America has come to expect even higher prices on houses, stocks, and a swath of other financial assets. Civic leaders and corporate executives routinely praise rising home prices and rallying stocks as signs of widespread economic well-being. But those rising asset prices are wedging an increasingly large gap between the wealth of older generations and their children and grandchildren. The gains are heavily concentrated in older Americans who are already homeowners and who invested many years ago when prices were lower. For those looking to embark on the American dream today, it is more out of reach than ever. Home buying affordability fell last year to the lowest level since 1985, according to a National Association of Realtors index. The median household now needs more than 40% of its income to cover payments on a median-priced home, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Hopes that the Fed would cut interest rates helped lower mortgage rates and unlock the housing market for a few months, but stubborn inflation has sent rates back above 7% and home sales sliding. In 2022, when the oldest millennials were about 40 years old, 61% of people ages 35 to 44 owned a home, according to the Fed. In 1989, when the oldest baby boomers were 43 years old, 66% of that age cohort owned a home. Our parents can't process that this is the new norm for home prices, said Anthony Fumo. Real estate, the largest source of wealth among U.S. households, drives much of the divergence between older generations, who own the bulk of home equity, and younger adults who are looking to buy their first homes. The Fed supported the housing market for years after the 2008 financial crisis, scooping up trillions of dollars worth of bonds backed by home mortgages. Easy financing conditions helped many Americans get their start into adulthood, while older homeowners benefited from rising prices. Now, the central bank is running down its portfolio of mortgage-backed securities, helping keep mortgage rates high. But the typical accompanying drop in prices hasn't happened. A years-long decline in housing construction has constrained the supply of houses, propping up prices. Homeowners who refinanced when the Fed slashed rates to near zero during the COVID-19 pandemic don't want to give up their 3% mortgages. A surge in immigration has increased the number of families looking for homes. Until demand slows or supply increases, home prices will continue to climb. The Fed is still on its front foot trying to tame inflation, meaning mortgage rates are primed to remain expensive. Put it all together, and many expect the wealth gap to continue widening. Americans 55 and up increased their overall assets to a record $114 trillion by the end of last year, up from $84 trillion just 4 years ago, according to Federal Reserve data. That accounts for nearly 70% of all households' $166 trillion. Their share sat at 51% 3 decades earlier. Working-age adults, meanwhile, have steadily lost their share of America's wealth. Households under 40 have less than $15 trillion, or a 9% slice of overall assets, well below the 14% they notched 30 years ago. Americans ages 40 to 54 own less than a quarter of all households' assets. They had nearly 40% in 2001. Chris and Jennifer Mulder, in their mid-40s and raising 3 children in Alexandria, Virginia, consider their timing very lucky. Chris Mulder bought his first house in 2003 while stationed in Georgia as an instructor pilot in the U.S. Air Force. Whenever he was relocated within the U.S., he bought a new home and rented out his old haunts. The two began refinancing their mortgages during the pandemic when rates dropped sharply. They have also benefited from raising rents, a corollary of the crunch in housing supply. Originally, renters only covered my mortgage payments and taxes, Chris said. Now the cash is flowing. Whenever he and Jennifer, an officer in the Air Force Reserve, transition out of the military, they plan to continue contributing to national security. But they don't feel pressure to get rich off whatever that may be, as passive income sources like their rental properties give them financial flexibility. Any extra income we earn, that'll be gravy, Chris said. States Lead in Barring Beijing from U.S. Economy by James T. Aretti. States have a new adversary, China. From Florida to Indiana and Montana, proposals, bills, laws, and regulations aim to block Chinese individuals and companies from acquiring land, winning contracts, working on research, setting up factories, and otherwise participating in the U.S. economy. State officials, overriding traditional local interests such as drawing investment and creating jobs, say they are addressing grassroots distrust of the Chinese Communist Party. China has a very clearly stated objective, and that is to dominate the world and do that at the U.S.'s expense, said Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, who last year blocked Ford Motor from setting up a battery venture with China's contemporary Amperex technology. Ford is now building a scaled-down version in Michigan, where it has also faced local resistance. When Iowa's state Senate passed a bill this month to shield some big chemical makers from certain pesticide lawsuits, it specified that a state-owned Chinese company would be ineligible. Grand Forks, North Dakota, last year stopped China's Fufeng Group from building a corn processing plant that promised to create 1,000 jobs. State and local authorities had initially welcomed the expected $700 million investment, but support collapsed and public anger rose after claims, with little substantiation, that the facility could be a conduit to spy on Grand Forks Air Force Base. Grand Forks had a duty to act because the federal government was slow and contradictory in addressing possible national security implications, Mayor Brandon Bochensky said. Last year, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem cited North Dakota's experience in signing an executive order that forbade many activities in her state by companies linked to governments the U.S. has designated as foreign adversaries, which included China's. Fufeng later identified a site in Indiana, only to be tripped up by a new law that forbids designated adversaries from entering deals for farmland. Safety or revenue, you sometimes have to make a decision, said Indiana State Senator Gene Leasing, one of the law's proponents. Fufeng said it is well into the process of exploring alternative sites. States are continuing to blur the lines between state power and federal power, said Christopher Daley, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana. Virginia's Youngkin said issues such as land use are state-level decisions. In the Iowa chemicals bill, which died Saturday when the House recessed before voting on it, the exception to protection seemed aimed at Syngenta, a Swiss maker of seeds and pesticides owned by government-controlled China National Chemical. In Arkansas, Syngenta was fined $280,000 and ordered to sell 160 acres it has owned for 36 years for violating a new law barring land holdings by a prohibited foreign party-controlled business. Florida has designated some of the furthest-reaching China decoupling. Last year, Governor Ron DeSantis signed a law to stop land purchases, block state contracting, and university partnerships involving Chinese nationals. Several states' efforts have faced legal challenges. And this will conclude the reading of the Wall Street Journal for today, Monday, April 29th, 2024. I'm Kim Sheridan, wishing you all the best.